eon of delirium passed before, unexpected, the vision came to him. So they were right. He had pondered blearily, looking up as a blaze of true light pierced the inky Venusian heat haze, stabbing his unaccustomed eyes, making them flow with tears. The ancients were right, after all. When death arrives, it's an angel that comes for you. The angel had bent closer. Behind a diamond-fringed face mask, fair hair had framed a face he dimly knew he should recognize. A familiar face, as if he had known it half his life. Lips moving. "So you're the Orly boy." The amplified voice had been soothing, though more efficient-sounding than angelic. "Not much to look at compared to your picture, but I'll reserve judgment till we get you cleaned up."
"He
had croaked. While hands drew him onto a stretcher, her face never leaving his sight, Tom felt life might slip away if it had. Working to pump remedies into his veins, she had kept on murmuring, "There now, it'll be all right. Say, don't you recognize me? We've never been introduced, but they've been nagging us to meet and get married." That first time, under the hellish sky of Venus, he had never once lost consciousness because of her. Now, though, all he had was a memory to cling to. Awareness bled away like bitter, irretrievable air. His first thought on coming around was a vague surprise that he was still breathing. Tom thought the battle storm was still going on until he realized that the shaking he felt was his own body. The roar in his ears was only a roar in his ears. His throbbing left arm was draped over a thick, horizontal stump. Scummy green water came up to his chin, lapping against the thinned face mask. His lungs ached, and the air was stale. He brought up his trembling right hand and pulled the mask down to hang around his neck. The filters had kept out the ozone stench, but he inhaled deeply, gratefully. At the last moment, he must have chosen immolation over suffocation, and struck out for the surface. Fortunately, the battle ended just before he arrived. Tom resisted the temptation to rub his itching eyes. The slime on his hands would do them no good. Tears welled at a biofeedback command, flushing most of the blinding mucus away. He looked up when he could see again. To the north, the volcano fumed on as ever. The cloud cover had parted somewhat, revealing numerous twisted banners of multicolored smoke. All around Tom, small crawling things were climbing out from the singed weeds, resuming their normal business of eating or being eaten. There were no longer battleships in the sky, blazing away at each other with beams of nova heat. For the first time, Tom was glad of the monotonous topography of the carpet of vines. He hardly had to rise in the water to see several columns of smoke pouring from slowly settling wrecks. As he watched, one faraway metal derelict exploded. The sound arrived seconds later in a series of muted coughs and pops, punctuated unsynchronously by bright flashes. The dim shape sank lower. Tom averted his eyes from the final detonation. When he looked back, he could detect nothing but clouds of steam and a faint hissing that fell away into silence. Elsewhere lay other floating fragments. Tom turned a slow circle, somewhat in awe of the destruction. There was more than enough wreckage for a mid-sized skirmish. He laughed at the irony, although it made his abused lungs hurt. The Galactics had all come to investigate a counterfeit Mayday signal, and they had brought their death feuds along to what should have been a mission of mercy. Now they were dead while he still lived. This didn't feel like the random capriciousness of Ifni. It was too like the mysterious, wry work of God himself. "Does this mean I'm all alone again?" he wondered. That would be rich. So much fireworks and one humble human the only survivor? Not for long, perhaps. The battle had caused him to lose almost all of the supplies he had struggled so hard to recover. Tom frowned suddenly. The message bombs. He clutched at his waist, and the world seemed to drop away. Only one of the globes remained. The others must have popped out in the struggle below the clinging vines. When his right hand stopped shaking, he carefully reached under his waistband and drew out the psi bomb, his very last link with Streaker, with Jillian. It was the verifier, the one that he was to set off if he thought the Trojan Seahorse should fly. Now he would have to decide whether to set off this one or none at all. Yes or no, were all he could say. I only wish I knew whose ships those were that fired on the Tandu. Tucking the bomb away, he resumed his slow turn. One wreck on the northwest horizon looked like a partially crushed eggshell. Smoke still rose from it, but the burning seemed to have stopped. There were no explosions, and it seemed not to be sinking any lower. All right, Tom thought. That will do as a goal. Looks intact enough to have possibilities. It may have salvageable gear and food. Certainly its shelter, if it's not too radioactive. It seemed only 5 kilometers away or so, though looks could be deceiving. A destination would give him something to do, at least. He needed more information. The wreck might tell what he needed to know. Tom pondered whether to try to go by land, trusting his weary legs to negotiate the weedscape, or to attempt the journey underwater, swimming from air hole to air hole, daring the unknown creatures of the deep. He suddenly heard a warbling whine behind him, turned, and saw a small spacecraft about 1 kilometer away, heading slowly northward, wavering bare meters above the ocean. Its shimmering shields flickered. Its drives heaved and faltered. Tom pulled up his mask and prepared to dive, but the tiny ship wasn't coming his way. It was passing to the west, sparks shooting from its stubby stasis flanges. Ugly black streaks stained its hull, and one patch had blistered and boiled away. Tom caught his breath as it passed. He had never seen a model like this before, but he could think of several races whose style would be compatible with the design. The scout dipped as its dying drives coughed. The high whine of the gravity generator began to fall. The boat's crew obviously knew it was done for. It banked to change course for the island. Tom held his breath, unable to help sympathizing with the desperate alien pilot. The boat sputtered along just above the weeds, then passed out of sight behind the mountain's shoulder. The faint crump of its landing carried over the whistling of the trade winds. Tom waited. After a few seconds, the boat's stasis field released with a loud concussion. Glowing debris flew out over the sea, the fragments quenched in water or burned slowly into the weeds. He doubted anyone could have gotten away in time. Tom changed goals. His long-range destination was still the eggshell ship, floating a few miles away, but first, he wanted to sift through the wreckage of that scout boat. Maybe there would be evidence there to make his decision easier. Maybe there would be food. He tried to crawl up onto the weeds, but found it too difficult. He was still shaking. All right, then. We'll go under the sea. Probably all moot anyway. I might as well enjoy the scenery. Chapter 52 Aki. The son of a blood-gorged lamprey just wouldn't let go. Aki was exhausted. The metallic tang of the water mixed with the taste of bile from his fore stomach as he swam hard to the southeast. He wanted desperately to rest, but he knew he couldn't afford to let his pursuer cut away at his lead. Now and then he caught sight of Cathajan, about 2 kilometers behind him, and closing the gap. The giant, darkly countershaded dolphin seemed tireless. His breath condensed in high vertical spouts, like small rockets of fog, as he plowed ahead through the water. Aki's breath was ragged, and he felt weak with hunger. He cursed in Anglic and found it unsatisfying. Playing over a resonating obscene phrase in primal Delphin helped a little. He should have been able to outdistance Cathar John, at least over a short stretch. But something in the water was affecting the hydrodynamic properties of his skin. Some substance was causing an allergic reaction. His normally smooth and pliant hide was scratchy and bumpy. He felt like he was plowing through syrup instead of water. Aki wondered why no one else had reported this. Did it only affect dolphins from Calathea? It was one more unfairness in a series that stretched back to the moment he had left the ship. Escaping Cathar John hadn't been as easy as he expected. Heading southeast, he should have been able to veer right or left to reach help, either Hikahi and the crew at the Thenanin wreck, or at Toshio's island. But every time he tried to change course, Cathar John moved to cut the corner. Aki couldn't afford to lose any more of his lead. A wave of focused sonar swept over him from behind. He wanted to curl up into a ball every time it happened. It wasn't natural for a dolphin to flee another for so long. In the deep past, a youngster who angered an older male by trying to copulate with a female in the old bull's harem, for instance, might get thumped or raked, but only rarely was a grudge held. Aki had to stifle an urge to stop and try to reason with Cathar John. What good would that do? The giant was obviously mad. His speed advantage was lost to this mysterious skin itch. Diving to get around Cathar John was also out of the question. The Stenos Bredonensis were pelagic dolphins. Cathar John could probably outdive anyone in the Streaker's crew. When next he glanced back, Cathar John had closed to within about 1 kilometer. Aki warbled a sigh and redoubled his efforts. A line of green-topped mounds lay near the horizon, perhaps 4 or 5 kilometers away. He had to hold on long enough to reach them. Chapter 53 Moki. Moki drove the sled at top speed to the south, blasting its sonar ahead like a bugle. "Calling Haoki, calling Moki, this is Herkapeet. Come in. Verify, please." Moki tossed his head in irritation. The ship was trying to reach him again. Moki clicked the sled's transmitter on and tried to talk clearly. "Yes! What you want?" There was a pause, then, "Moki, let me talk to Haoki." Moki barely concealed a laugh. "Haoki, dead. Killed by intruder. I'm chasing now. Tell Takata Jim I'll get to them." Moki's Anglic was almost indecipherable, yet he didn't dare use Trinary. He might slip into Primal in public, and he wasn't ready for that yet. There was a long silence on the sonar speak line. Moki hoped that now they'd leave him alone. When he and Haoki had found the Baskin woman's empty sled, drifting slowly westward at low power, something had finally snapped within him. He had then entered a confused but exalted state, a blur of action, like a violent dream. Perhaps they were ambushed, or perhaps he merely imagined it. But when it was over, Haoki was dead, and he, Moki, had no regrets. After that, his sonar had picked up an object heading south, another sled. Without another thought, he had given chase. The sonar speak crackled. "Herka again. Moki, you're getting out of Caesar range, and we still can't use radios. You are now given 2 orders. First, relay a sonar speak message to Cathar John, ordering him back. His mission is canceled. Number two, after that, turn around yourself. That's a direct order. The lights and dots meant little to Moki anymore. What mattered were the patterns of sound that the sled sensors sent him. The expanded hearing sense gave him a godlike feeling, as if he were one of the great dreamers himself. He imagined himself a huge katydid, a sperm whale, lord of the deep, hunting prey that fled at any hint of his approach. Not far to the south was the muffled sound of a sled, the one he had been chasing for some time. He could tell that he was catching up to it. Much farther away, and to the left, were two tiny rhythmic signals, sounds of rapid cetacean swimming. That had to be Cathod John and the upstart Calathian. Moki would dearly love to steal Cathod John's prey from him, but that could wait. The first enemy lay dead ahead.
Moki, you copy me? Answer! You have your orders! You must!
Moki clapped his jaws in disgust. He shut off the sonar speak in the middle of Herka Pete's complaint. It was getting hard to understand the stuck-up little petty officer anyway. He had never been much of a Stenos, always studying Kanik with the Tersiops and trying to better himself. Moki decided he would look the fellow up after he had finished taking care of his enemies outside the ship. Chapter 54 Kipiru. Kipiru knew he was being followed. He had expected that someone might be sent after him to keep him from reaching Hikahi. But his pursuer was some sort of idiot. He could tell from the distant whine of the engines that the Finn sled was being driven well beyond its rated speed. What did the fellow hope to accomplish? Kipiru had a long enough head start to make it within sonar speak range of the Thenanin wreck before his pursuer caught up. He only had to push his sled's throttle slightly into the red. The Finn behind him was spraying sonar noise all over the place, as if he wanted to announce to all and sundry that he was coming. With all his screeching, the imbecile was making it hard for Kipiru to piece together what was going on to the southeast. Kipiru concentrated and tried to block out the noise from behind. Two dolphins, it seemed, one almost out of breath, the other powerful and still vigorous, were swimming furiously toward a bank of sonar shadows 50 kilometers away. What was going on? Who was chasing whom? He was listening so narrowly that Kipiru suddenly was yanked back to the present and had to veer to avoid colliding with a high seamount. He passed on the west side, banking hard to sweep past by meters. The mountain's bulk momentarily cast him into silence. "Where shoals, child of Tersiops?" He trilled a lesson rhyme, then switched to trinary haiku. Echoes of the shore are like drifting feathers dropped by pelicans. Kipiru chided himself. Dolphins were supposed to be hot pilots. It was what had won them their first starship berths over a century before, and he was known far and wide as one of the best. So why were 40 knots underwater harder to handle than 50 times light speed down a wormhole? His thrumming sled left the shadow of the seamount and came into open water. East of southeast came a faint image gestalt of racing cetaceans once again. Kipiru concentrated. Yes, the one in pursuit was a Stenos, a big one. It used a strange pattern of search sonar. The one in front... It has to be Aki, he thought. The kid is in trouble, bad trouble. He was almost deafened as a blast of sound from the sled behind him caught him directly in a focused beam. Kipiru chattered a curse glyph and shook his head to clear it. Tempted to turn around to take care of the self-sucking turd swallower behind him. Kipiru was tormented by a choice. Strictly speaking, his duty was to get a message to Hikahi, yet it went against everything inside him to abandon the Midi. It sounded like the youngster was exhausted. His pursuer was clearly catching up. But if he swung to the east, he would give his own pursuer a chance to catch up. But he might also distract Katha John, force him to turn around. It didn't become a Terrigan's officer. It didn't reflect Kanik. But he couldn't decide logically. He wished some distant great-great-grandchild of his were here now, a fully mature and logical dolphin who could tell his crude, half-animal ancestor what to do. Kipiru sighed. What makes me think they'll let me have great-grandchildren anyway? Finally, he chose to be true to himself. He banked the sled to the left and pulled the engine throttle one more notch into the red. Chapter 55 Charles Dart. One of the two Earthlings in the room, the human, rummaged through dresser drawers and distractedly tossed things into an open valise on the bed. He listened while the chimpanzee talked.
The probe is down below 2 kilometers. The radioactivity's rising fast, and the temperature gradient, too. I'm not sure the probe will last more than another few hundred meters, yet the shaft keeps going. Anyway, I'm now positive that there's been garbage dumping by a technological race, and recently, like hundreds of years ago.
That's very interesting, Dr. Dart.
Really, it is. Ignacio Metz tried not to show his exasperation. One had to be patient with chimps, especially Charles Dart. Still, it was hard to pack while the chimp ran on and on, perched on a chair in his stateroom. Dart went on obliviously.
If anything made me appreciate Toshio, as inefficient as that boy is having to work with that lousy dolphin linguist, Sout. Still, I was getting good data until Tom Orley's damn bomb went off, and Sout started hollering stuff about voices from below. Crazy bloody Finn.
Metz sorted his belongings. Now, where is my blue land suit? Oh, yes, it's already packed. Let's see. Duplicates of all my notes are already loaded aboard the boat. What else is there?
I said, Dr. Metz.
Hmm? He looked up quickly. I'm sorry, Dr. Dart. It's all these sudden changes and all. I'm sure you understand. What were you saying? Dart groaned in exasperation.
I said, I want to go with you. To you, this trip may be a form of exile, but to me, it'd be an escape. I've got to get out to where my work is.
He pounded the wall and showed 2 rows of large yellowed teeth. Metz thought for a moment, shaking his head. Exile? Perhaps Dakota Jim looked at it that way. Certainly, he and Jillian were like oil and water. She was determined to set in motion Orley's and Crydike's Trojan seahorse plan. Dakota Jim was just as adamant resisting it. Metz agreed with Dakota Jim and had been surprised when the lieutenant meekly resigned his acting captaincy at the ship's council meeting, appointing Jillian in command until Hikahi could be recalled. That meant the seahorse scheme would go forward after all. Streaker was to begin her underwater move in a few hours. If the ruse was really to be tried, Metz was just as happy to be gone from the ship. The longboat was spacious and comfortable enough. In it, he and his notes would be safe. The records of his special experiments would get to Earth eventually, even when... If Streaker was destroyed trying to escape. Besides, now he could join Denny Sudman in examining the Kikwi. Metz was more than a little eager to get a look at the pre-sentience.
You'll have to talk to Jillian about coming with us, Charlie.
He shook his head.
She's letting us take your new robot with us to the island. You may have to settle for that.
But you and Takata Jim promised that if I cooperated, if I kept quiet to Toshio earlier, and was willing to give you my proxy on the council.
The chip lapsed when he saw the expression on Ness's face. Charlie's lips pressed close together, and he got up to his feet.
Thanks for nothing,
he growled as he went for the door. Now, Charlie. Dart marched out into the hall. The shutting door cut off Metz's last words. The chimp walked along the sloping corridor, head bowed in determination.
I gotta get out there, he grumbled. There's gotta be a way.
This ends side one of cassette 8. Cassette 8, side 2.
Chapter 56 Sout. When Jillian called to ask that he talk to Krydike, his first thought had been to rebel over the workload.
I know, her tiny simulacrum had agreed. But you're the only one I can spare who has the qualifications. Let's rephrase that. You are the only one for the job. Krydike is clearly aware and alert, but he can't talk. We need someone to help him communicate through parts of his brain that weren't damaged. You're our expert.
Stout had never really liked Krydike, and the type of injury the captain had suffered made Stout feel queasy. Still, the challenge appealed to his vanity.
What about Charles Dart? He's been driving Toshio and me until our flukes droop, and he has top priority on this line.
In the small holo image, Jillian looked very tired.
Not anymore, he doesn't. We're sending out a new probe with Dakota Gem and Metz, one he'll be able to control himself by comlink. Until then, his project takes last place. Last place, is that understood?
Sal clapped his jaw loudly in assent. It felt good to hear decisive leadership again. The fact that the voice was that of a human he respected helped, too.
This bit about Metz and Takata Jim. I've filled in Toshio, Jillian said. He'll brief you when the chance comes. He is in absolute charge now. You're to obey him with alacrity. Is that clear?
Jillian never lost her vocabulary under pressure. Sal liked that.
Yes, eminently. Now, about these resonances I'm getting from the planet's crust. What shall I do? They are, to my knowledge, totally unprecedented. Can you spare someone to do a library search for me?
Jillian frowned.
You say resonances of apparent intelligent origin are coming from deep in Kithrop's crust? Exactly.
Jillian rolled her eyes.
Ifni, to explore this world in peace and quiet would demand a decade of work by a dozen survey ships.
She shook her head.
No, my quick guess is that some formation of probability-sensitive rock below the surface is resonating with emanations from the battle overhead. In any event, it comes after the other priorities, security, the Kikwi, and talking to Krydike. You've got a mouthful to deal with already.
Stout stifled a protest. Complaining would only get Jillian to order him explicitly away from the probe. She hadn't yet, so it would be best to stay quiet.
Now think about your options, Jillian reminded him. If Streaker makes a break for it, we'll try to get the skiff out to pick up Tom and whoever wants to join us from the island. You can choose to come along, or stay with Metz and Takata Jim and wait it out in the longboat. Inform Toshio of your decision.
I understand. I'll think about it.
Somehow the issue seemed less urgent than it would have a few days ago. The sounds from below were having an effect on him.
If I stay, I still wish you all the best of luck, he added.
You too, Melfin, Jillian smiled. You're a strange duck, but if I get home, I'm going to recommend you get lots of grandchildren.
Her image vanished as she broke the connection. Sout stared at the blank screen. The compliment, wholly unexpected, left him momentarily stunned. Then a few Kikwi, who were foraging nearby, were surprised to see a large dolphin rise up onto his tail and dance about the small pool. To be noticed by a humpback, to be credited at last for being me. Chapter 57 Denny and Toshio. I'm afraid. Almost without a thought, Toshio put his arm around Denny's shoulder. He gave her a reassuring squeeze.
What for? There's nothing to be scared of.
Denny looked up from the pounding breakers to see if he was serious. Then she realized she was being teased. She stuck out her tongue at him. Toshio inhaled deeply and was content. It wasn't clear to him where his new relationship with Denny was going. It wasn't physical, for one thing. They had slept together last night, but fully clothed. Toshio had thought it would be frustrating, and it was, sort of, but not as much as he had expected. It would work out one way or another. Right now, Denny needed someone to be nearby. It was satisfying just filling that need. Maybe, when all this was over, she would go back to thinking of him as a boy, 4 years her junior. Somehow he doubted it. She was touching him more now, rather than less, holding his arm and punching him in mock anger, even as memories from the Psi Bomb episode faded.
When are they supposed to get here with the longboat?
She looked back over the ocean once more. Late tomorrow sometime, he answered.
Takata, Jim, and Metz wanted to negotiate with the ETs. What's to stop them if they decide to ignore orders and try anyway?
Jillian's giving them only enough power to get here. They have a regenerator, so they'll be able to charge up for space travel in a month or so. By then, Straker'd be gone one way or another. Denny shivered. Toshio cursed his awkward tongue.
Takata Jim won't have a radio. I'm to guard ours until the skiff comes to pick us up. Besides, what could he offer the Galactics? He won't have any of the charts marking the derelict fleet.
My guess is he and Metz will wait until everybody leaves, then scuttle off to Earth with Metz's tapes and a hold full of gripes. Denny looked up at the first stars of the long Kithrip twilight.
Are you going back? She asked.
Streaker's my ship. Thank God Krydike is still alive, but even if he's not skipper anymore, I owe it to him to keep on, as one of his officers should. Denny glanced up at him briefly, then nodded and looked back out at the sea. She's thinking we haven't a chance, Toshio realized. And maybe we don't. Wearing a feminine battle wagon as a disguise, we'll have all the maneuverability of a Calathian mud gleaner. And even fooling the Galactics might not be so good an idea. They want to capture Streaker, but they won't hold back their fire if they see a defeated enemy climbing back up for another round. There still have to be Thenanin around if this scheme is to work. But we can't just sit here waiting, can we? If we do, the Galactics will learn that they can push Earthlings around. We just can't afford to let anyone profit from chasing one of our survey ships. Toshio changed the subject.
How's your report coming?
Oh, all right, I guess. It's clear the Kikwi are fully presentient. They've been fallow a very long time. In fact, some Darwinist heretics might think they were just getting ripe to bootstrap themselves. They show signs. Some iconoclast humans still pushed the idea that a pre-sentient race could make the leap to spacefaring intelligence by evolution alone, without the intervention of a patron. Most Galactics thought the idea absurd and strange, but the failure to find humanity's missing benefactor had regained the theory a few adherents.
What about the metal mound?
Toshio asked about Denny's other research, begun at Charlie Dart's behest when the chimp had been given top priority, but pursued now out of interest. Denny shrugged.
Oh, the mound's alive.
The professional biologist in me would give her left arm to be able to stay a year on this island with full laboratory equipment. The metal-eating pseudo-coral, the drill tree, the living core of the island, are all symbiotes. In effect, they're organs in one giant entity. If I could only write it up at home, I'd be famous if anyone believed me.
Well, they'll believe you, Toshio assured her. And you'll be famous.
He motioned that they should start heading back to camp. They only had a little time after second supper to walk and talk. Now that he was in command, he had to make sure that timetables were kept. Denny held his arm as they turned to return to the encampment. Over the rushing rustle of the wind through the foliage came the intermittent squeaks of the natives, rousing from their siesta to prepare for the evening hunt. They walked in silence along the narrow trail. Chapter 58 Galactics. Krat licked slowly at her mating claw, studiously ignoring the creatures who scurried to clean up the bloody mess in the corner. They would be trouble over this. The Pelan High Council would protest. Of course, she was within her rights, as Grand Admiral, to deal with any member of the fleet as she saw fit. But that did not traditionally cover the skewering of a senior librarian, simply because he was the bearer of bad news. "I am getting old," she realized, "and the daughter I had hoped would soon be strong enough to pull me down is now dead. Who now will do me the honors before I grow erratic and become a hazard to the clan?" The small furry body was hauled away, and a sturdy paha mopped up the bloody mess. The other Pila looked at her. "Let them stare. When we capture the Earthlings, it won't matter. I shall be famous, and this incident will be ignored by all, especially the Pila. If we are the first ones to approach the progenitors with an offering, the law won't matter anymore. The Pila will not simply be our adult liege clients. They will be ours again, to meddle with, to redesign, to shape once more."
"Back to work! All!"
She snapped her mating claw. The twang sent the bridge crew scuttling off to their stations, some to repair the smoking damage from a near miss in the most recent battle with the Tandu. "Think now, Sorrow Mother. Can you spare ships to send once more to the planet, to that hellish volcano where every fleet has already sent a party to fight and die? There weren't supposed to be any Gubru left here, but a battered Gubru scout had shown up at the place where the distress call came from. It had gone to smoky ruin along with a Tandu destroyer. Prittle's ship, number 16, and two other vessels, even her battle computers could not identify. Perhaps one was a surviving spear ship of the Brothers of the Night, which had hidden on one of Kithrop's moons. Meanwhile, out here, the final battle with the Tandu's unholy alliance had turned into a bloody draw. The Sorrow still had a slim advantage, so the remaining Thenanin stayed by their Tandu allies. Should she risk all in the next encounter? For the Tandu to win would be horrible. They would, if they gained the power, destroy so many beautiful species that the Sorrow might someday own. If it came down to a choice, she guessed the Thenanin would switch sides one more time.
"Strategy section," she snapped.
"Fleet Mother?" A paha warrior approached, but stopped just out of arm reach. It eyed her cautiously. Given a chance, she would breed respect into the paha genes so deeply nothing would ever eradicate it. The paha stepped back involuntarily as her claws stretched.
"Find out which ships are now most expendable. Organize them into a small squadron. We're going to investigate the planet again."
The paha saluted and returned to its station quickly. Krat settled deeper into the Vletor cushion.
We shall need a distraction, she thought. Perhaps another expedition to that volcano would make the Thenanin nervous and let the Tandu think we know something. Of course, she reminded herself, the Tandu themselves may know what we do not. Chapter 59 Crydike. Far away, they call, the giants, the spirits of ocean, the leviathans. Crydike begins to understand. Does begin. The old gods are part figment, part racial memory, part ghost, and part something else. Something an engineer could never have allowed his ears to hear or eyes to see. Far away, they call. Leviathans. Not yet. Not yet. Not. Crydike has a duty to perform yet. Does have a duty. No more. No more an engineer. But Crydike remains a spacer. Not useless. Crydike will do what he can. Can do. Can do to help. Can do to help. Save his crew, his ship. Chapter 60 Jillian. She wanted to rub her eyes, but the face mask was in the way. Too much remained to be done. The Finns came and went, swooping by her wherever she traveled in the ship, almost toppling her in their hurry to report and then be off again, carrying out orders. I hope Hikaki gets back soon. I'm not doing badly, I guess, but I'm no starship officer. She has the training to rule a crew. Hikaki doesn't even know she's captain, Jillian thought. Much as I pray they get the line open soon, I'll hate having to break that news to her. She wrote a brief message to Emerson Dionetti, and the last courier dashed off for the engine room. Wattasetti kept pace alongside her as she turned to swim into the outlook. There were two small crowds of dolphins in the bay, one at the forward sally hatch and the other clustered about the longboat. The bow of the small spaceship almost touched the iris of one of the outer hatches. Its stern disappeared into a metal sheath beyond the rear end of the outlook. When the longboat is gone, this place will look pretty empty, she thought. A Finn in the party at the lock saw her and sped toward Jillian. He halted abruptly before her and hovered in the water at attention. Flankers and scouts are ready to depart when you give the word, Jillian. Thank you, Zaft. It will be soon. Is there still no word from the line repair party or from Kipiru? No, sir. The courier you sent to follow Kipiru should be near the wreck shortly, though. It was frustrating. Takana Jim had severed the link to the Thenanin wreck, and now it seemed impossible to find the break. For once, she cursed the fact that monofilaments could be hidden so well. For all they knew, some terrible disaster might have struck the work party at the very site where she was planning on moving Streaker. At least the detectors indicated the space battle was still going on, almost as fierce as ever. But what was keeping Tom? He was supposed to set off a message bomb when ETs showed up to investigate his ruse. But since the fake distress call, there had been nothing. In addition to everything else, the damn NIS machine wanted to talk to her. It had not set off the hidden alarm in her office to indicate that it was an emergency, but every time she used a comm unit, she heard a faint click that signaled the thing's desire to talk. It was enough to make a femme just want to climb into bed and stay there. A sudden commotion broke out near the lock. The wall speaker let out a brief, sloppy squeal of trinary, followed by a longer report in loose, high-pitched Anglic.
Sir!
Zoft turned excitedly.
They report.
I heard, she nodded. The line's been repaired. Congratulate the repair team for me, and get them inside for a couple of hours' rest. Then please ask Herkapete to contact Hikahi right away. He's to ascertain her situation and tell her we begin moving the ship at 2100 hours unless she objects. I'll be calling her shortly.
Aye, sir, Zaft whirled and sped off.
Wata said he watched her silently, waiting.
All right, she said. Let's see Takata Jim and Metz off. You've made certain the crew has offloaded anything not on our checklist and inspected everything the exiles took aboard?
Yes, they haven't even got a flare gun, no radio, and no more fuel than the minimum needed to reach the island.
Jillian had gone on her own inspection of the boat a few hours back, while Metz and Takata Jim were still packing. She had taken a few additional precautions that nobody else knew about.
Who's going with them?
3 volunteers, all of them strange, Stenos. All males. We searched them down to their penile sheaths. They're clean, all in the longboat now, ready to go.
Jillian nodded.
Then, for better or worse, let's get them out of here so we can get on with other things.
Mentally, she had already begun rehearsing what she had to tell Hikahi. Chapter 61 Hikahi and Suesi.
Remember, she told Tisht and Suesi, maintain radio silence at all cost, and try to keep those crazy Fen in the wreck from eating up all the supplies in the first few days, hmm?
Tisht signaled assent with a jaw clap, although her eyes were heavy with reservation. Suesi said,
Are you sure you won't let one of us come with you?
I'm sure if I encounter disaster, I want no more lives lost. If I find survivors, I might need every bit of room.
In any event, the skiff runs itself, essentially. All I have to do is watch it.
You can't fight while piloting, Hannes pointed out.
If I had a gunner along, I might be tempted to fight. This way I have to run away. If Streaker is dead or captured, I must be able to return the skiff to you here, or you'll all be doomed.
Suesi frowned, but found he had to agree with her reasoning.
He was thankful Hikahi had stayed as long as she had, letting them use the skiff's power to finish preparing a habitat inside the wreck.
We're all worried about Streaker and the captain, he thought, but Hikahi must be in agony.
All right, then. Goodbye and good luck, Hikahi. May Ifni's boss watch over you.
The same to both of you.
Hikahi took Suesi's hand gently between her jaws, then did the same with Tisht's left pectoral fin. Tisht and Suesi left through the skiff's small airlock. They backed their sled toward the yawning opening in the sunken alien battleship. A low whine spread from the skiff as power came on. The sound echoed back to them from the mammoth sea cliff that towered over the crash site. The tiny space vessel began to move slowly eastward, picking up speed underwater. Hikahi had chosen a roundabout route, taking her far out before swinging back in an arc to Streaker's hiding place. This would keep her out of touch for as long as a couple of days, but it would also mean that her point of origin could not be traced if an enemy lay in wait where Streaker had been. They watched until the boat disappeared into the gloom. Long after Suesi ceased hearing anything, Tisht waved her jaw slowly back and forth, following the diminishing sound. 2 hours later, as Hannes was lying down for his first nap in his new dry quarters, the makeshift intercom by his pallet squawked.
Not more bad news, he sighed.
Lying in the darkness with one arm over his eyes, he touched the comm.
What? He said simply.
It was Lucky Ka, the young electronics tech and junior pilot. His voice fizzed with excitement.
Sir, Tisht says you should come quickly. It's the ship.
Suessi rolled over onto one elbow.
Streaker? Yes, the line just reopened. They want to talk to Hikaki right away.
All of the strength went out of Suessi's arms. He slumped back and groaned. Oh, frabjous day. By now, she's well out of sonar speak range. At times like these, I wish I talked dolphin jabber like Tom Orley. Maybe Trinary could express something properly ironic and vulgar about the way the universe works. Chapter 62 Exiles. The longboat slid smoothly through the port and out into the twilight blue of Kithrop's ocean.
You're going the wrong way,
Ignacio Met said after the iris closed behind them. Instead of turning east, the boat spiraled upward.
Just a small detour, Dr. Metz,
Takata Jim soothed.
Sneak a Joe! Tell Streaker I'm adjusting the trim.
The dolphin on the co-pilot's ramp began whistling to his counterpart on the ship. The sonar speak squawked back angrily. Streaker also had noticed the change in course. Mess's seat was above and behind Takata Jim's. The water level came up to his waist.
What are you doing? He asked.
Just getting used to the controls.
Well, watch out. You're headed straight for the detection buoys.
Metz watched, amazed, as the craft sped toward the crew of dolphins, dismantling the listening devices. The work fin scattered out of the way, cursing shrilly as the boat crashed into the tethered buoys. Metal smithereens clattered along its prow and fell into blackness. The sonar speak squawked. Dr. Metz blushed. Good fin person shouldn't use language like that. Takata Jim seemed oblivious. He calmly turned the small ship around and piloted it at a sedate pace eastward toward their island destination. The longboat drove down a narrow canyon, leaving the brightly lit subsea veil and Streaker behind it.
Tell them it was an accident,
Takata Jim told his co-pilot.
The trim was out of line, but now we've got it under control. We're proceeding underwater to the island as ordered.
Accident my hairy Uncle Fred scrotum.
The words were followed by a sniggering laugh from the back of the control room.
You know, I kind of figured you wouldn't leave without destroying the incriminating evidence first, Takata Jim.
Dr. Metz struggled with his straps to turn around. He stared.
Charles Dart, what are you doing here?
Perched on a shelf in a storage locker, whose door was now open, a space-suited chimpanzee grinned back at him.
Why, exercising a teeny-tiny bit of initiative, Dr. Metz. Now, you be sure and note that in your records. I want to be given credit for it.
He broke into a shrieking giggle, amplified by his suit speaker. Takata Jim twisted about on his ramp to regard the chimp for a moment. He snorted and turned back to his piloting. Charlie visibly screwed up his nerve to slide out of the cabinet into the water, even though none of it could touch him through the spacesuit. He floundered in the liquid up to his helmet ring.
But how?
Metz started to ask. Charlie hefted a large, heavy, waterproof sack from the locker to a man seat next to Metz.
I used deductive reasoning, he said as he climbed up. I figured Jillian's boys would only be watching out for misbehaving by a few grumbling stenos. So, thought I, why not get to the longboat by a route they wouldn't even think of watching?
Metz's eyes widened.
The sleeve? You crawled into one of the sealed maintenance ways that the builders used on Earth and made your way to the boat's access panels down by the thrust motors. Righto!
Charlie beamed as he buckled his seatbelt.
You probably had to remove some plates in the sleeve wall using a jack pry.
No dolphin could manage such a thing in an enclosed space, so they didn't think of it.
No, they didn't.
Metz looked Charlie up and down.
You passed pretty close to the thrusters. Did you get cooked?
My suit rad meter says raw to medium rare.
Charlie mocked, blowing at his fingertips. Metz grinned.
I shall indeed take note of this rare display of ingenuity, Dr. Dart. And welcome aboard. I'll be too busy anyway inspecting the Kikwi to take proper care of that robot of yours.
Now you can do it right.
Dart nodded eagerly.
That's why I'm here.
Excellent. Perhaps we can have a few games of chess as well.
I'd like that.
They sat back and watched as the ocean ridges passed by. Every few minutes one would look at the other and would burst out laughing. The Stenos were silent.
What's in the sack?
Metz pointed to the large satchel on Dart's lap. Charlie shrugged.
Personal effects, instruments, only the barest, most minuscule, most Spartan necessities.
Metz nodded and settled back again. It would indeed be nice to have the chimpanzee along on the trip. Dolphins were fine people, of course, but mankind's older client race had always struck him as better conversationalists, and dolphins didn't play chess worth a damn. It was an hour later that Metz recalled Charlie's first words on announcing his presence aboard. Just what did the chimp mean when he accused Takata Jim of destroying evidence? That was a very strange thing to say. He put the question to Dart.
Ask the lieutenant,
Charlie suggested.
He seemed to know what I meant. We're not exactly on speaking terms,
he grumbled. Metz nodded earnestly.
I will ask him as soon as we get settled on the island. I will certainly do that.
Chapter 63 Tom Orley. In the tangled shadows below the weed carpet, he made his way cautiously from air hole to air hole. The face mask helped him stretch a deep breath a long way, especially when he got near the island and had to search for an opening to the shore. Tom finally crawled out onto land just as the orange sun, Kestemene, slipped behind a thick bank of clouds to the west. The long Kithrop day would last for a while yet, but he missed the direct warming of the sun's rays. Evaporation chill made him shiver as he pulled himself through a gap in the weeds and up the rocky shoreline. He climbed on his hands and knees to a hummock a few meters above the sea and sat back heavily against the rough basalt. Then he pulled the breathing mask down around his neck. The island seemed to rock slowly, as if it were a cork bobbing in the sea. It would take a while to grow used to solid ground again. Just long enough, he realized ironically, for him to finish what he had to do here and get back into the water again. He pulled clumps of green slime from his shoulders and shivered as the damp slowly evaporated. Hunger. Ah, there was that too. It took his mind off the damp and chill, at least. He thought about pulling out his last food bar, but decided it could wait. It was all within 1,000 kilometers that he could eat, barring what he might find in alien wreckage. Smoke still rose where the small E.T. scout had crashed, just over the shoulder of the mountain. The thin stream climbed to merge high above with sooty drifts from the volcano's crater. Once in a while, Tom heard the mountain itself growl. Okay, let's move. He gathered his feet beneath him and pushed off. The world wavered unsteadily. Still, he was pleasantly surprised to find himself standing without too much trouble. Maybe Jill's right, he thought. Maybe I have reserves I've never touched before. He turned to his right, took a step, and almost tripped. He recovered, then stumbled along the rocky slope, thankful for his webbed gloves when it came to climbing over jagged rocks, serrated like chipped flint. One step after another, he drew near the source of the smoke. Topping a small rise, he came into view of the wreck. The scout had broken into three pieces. The stern section lay submerged, only its torn front end protruding from the charred weeds in the shallows. Tom checked the radiation meter at the rim of his face mask. He could stand the dose for a few days if necessary. The forward half of the wreck had split longitudinally, spilling the contents of the cockpit along a stony strand. Loose banners of fine wire wafted above metal bulkheads, which had been pulled and twisted apart like taffy. Looks easy enough, Tom thought. I just go down and inspect the damn thing. One step at a time. He thought about drawing his needler, but decided it would be better to have both hands free in case he fell. There wasn't much left. Tom poked through the scattered small pieces, recognizing bits of various machines, but nothing told him what he wanted to know, and there was no food. Large bent sheets of metal lay everywhere. Tom approached one that seemed to have cooled off and tried to lift it. It was too heavy to budge more than a few inches before he had to let it drop. Tom panted with his hands on his knees for a moment, breathing heavily. A few meters away was a great pile of driftwood. He went over and pulled out a few of the thicker stumps of dried seaweed. They were tough, but too springy to use as pry bars. Tom scratched his stubble and thought. He looked at the sea, covered all the way to the horizon with vile, slimy vines. Finally, he started gathering dried vines together into two piles. After dark, he sat by a driftwood fire, weaving tough strands of vine into a pair of large flat fans, somewhat like tennis rackets with loops on one side. He wasn't sure they would work as desired, but tomorrow he would find out. He sang softly in trinary to distract himself from his hunger. The whistled nursery rhyme echoed softly from the nearby cliffside. Hands and fire, use them, to leap higher. Dreams and song, use them, to leap long. Tom stopped suddenly and cocked his head. After a silent moment, he slid his needler out of its holster. Had he heard a sound? Or was it his imagination? He rolled quietly out of the firelight and crouched in the shadows, looking into the darkness, and, like a dolphin, tried to listen to the shape of things. In a stalker's crouch, from cover to cover, he made a slow circuit of the wreckage-strewn beach. Var kin kemp anatan plekeno vahumenif? Tom dove behind a hull shard and rolled over, breathing open-mouthed to keep silent. He listened.
Behumin kintsunp.
The voice resonated as if from a metal cavity, from under one of the large pieces of wreckage. A survivor? Who would have imagined? Tom called out.
Birkekklemp, behumin idisk, vithinin cliff fif.
He waited. When the voice in the darkness answered, Tom was up and running.
Idates, Visenenkliff.
He dove once again and fetched up against another shard of metal, then crawled on his elbows and took a quick look around the side of the bulkhead, and aimed his weapon directly into the eyes of a large reptiloid face, only a meter away. The face grimaced in the dim starlight. He had only met Thenanin once, and studied them at the school on Kathrenalin for 1 week. The creature was half squashed under a massive warped metal plate. Tom could guess its expression was one of agony. The scout's arms and back had been broken under the piece of hull.
The human Tibarchitpa.
Tom adjusted to the dialect the other spoke, a version of Galactic Six.
would not kill you, human, had I even the means. I wish only to persuade you to talk to me and distract me for a time.
Tom holstered the needler and moved to sit cross-legged in front of the pilot. It would only be polite to listen to the creature, and be ready to put him out of his misery if he asked the favor. I grieve that I am unable to succor you, Tom answered in Galactic Six. Though you are an enemy, I have never been one to call Thenanin wholly evil. The creature grimaced again, his ridge crest bumped intermittently against the metal roof, and he winced each time.
Nor do we think of human Vlek as totally without promise, though recalcitrant, wild, and irreverent.
Tom bowed, accepting as whole the partial compliment. I am prepared to do the service of termination, should you wish it, he offered.
You are kind, but that is not our way. I will wait as my pain balances my life. The great ghosts shall judge me brave.
Tom lowered his gaze. May they judge you brave. The Thenanin breathed raggedly, eyes closed. Tom's hand drifted to his waistband. He touched the bulge that was the message bomb. Are they still waiting back at Streaker? He wondered. What will Krydike decide to do if he doesn't hear from me? I must know what's been happening in the battle above Kithrib. For conversation and distraction, he offered, shall we exchange questions? The Thenanin opened his eyes. They actually seemed to hold a hint of gratitude.
Nice. A nice idea. As elder, I shall begin. I will ask simple questions, so as not to strain you.
Tom shrugged. Almost 300 years we've had the library. We've had 6,000 years of intricate civilization, and still, nobody believes humans could be anything but ignorant savages.
Why did you not from Morgren flee to a safer haven?
The scout asked.
Earth could not protect you, nor even those scoundrel Timbrimi who lead you into evil ways. But the abdicators are strong. You would have found safety with us. Why did you not come into our arms?
He made it all sound so simple. If only it were so. If only there had been a truly powerful alignment to flee to, one that would have not charged in return more than Streaker's crew or Earth could afford to pay. How to tell the Thenanin that his abdicators were only slightly less unpalatable than most of the other fanatics? It is our policy never to surrender to bullying threats, Tom said. Never. Our history tells us the value of this tradition more than those brought up on the library annals could imagine. Our discovery will be given only to the Galactic Institutes and only by our Terrigan's Council leaders themselves. At mention of Streaker's discovery, the Thenanin's face showed unmistakable interest, but he waited his turn, allowing Tom the next question. Are the Thenanin victorious over him? Tom asked anxiously. I saw Tandu. Who prevails in the sky?
Air whistled through the pilot's breathing vents.
The glorious fail. The killer Tandu thrive, and sorrow pagans abound. We harass where we can, but the glorious have failed. Heretics shall gain the prize.
It was a bit of a tactless way to put it, with one of the prizes sitting in front of him. Tom cursed softly. What was he going to do? None of the Thenanin survived, but could he tell Krydike to go ahead and take off on that basis? Should they try a ruse which, even if successful, would gain them allies too weak to do any good? The Thenanin breathed raggedly. Although it was not his turn, Tom asked the next question. Are you cold? I will move my fire here. Also, there is work I must do as we talk. Forgive this junior patron if I offend.
The feminine looked at him with purple, cat-irised eyes.
Politely spoken. We are told you humans are without manners. Perhaps you are merely unlearned, yet well-meaning.
The scout wheezed and blew sand grains from his breathing slits, while Tom quickly moved his camp. By the flickering flame light, the Fenanin sighed.
It is appropriate that, trapped and dying on a primitive world, I shall be warmed by the crafty fire-making skills of a wolfling. I shall ask you to tell a death-bound being about your discovery. No secrets, just a story. A story about the miracle of the Great Return.
Tom drew forth the memory, one that still gave him chills. Consider ships, he began. Think of starships, ancient, pitted, and great as moons.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 8, Star Tide Rising, Cassette 9.
When he awakened next to the warm coals of his fire, the dawn was barely breaking, casting long dim shadows along the beach. Tom felt much better. His stomach had become resigned to a fast, and sleep had done him a lot of good. He was still weak, but he felt ready to try a dash for the next possible haven. He got up, brushed off the multicolored sand, and peered to the north. Yes, the floating derelict was still there. Hope on the horizon. To his left, under the massive bulkhead, the Fenanin scout breathed softly, slowly dying. It had fallen asleep listening to Tom's story of the shallow cluster, of the shining giant ships, and the mysterious symbols on their sides. Tom doubted the creature would ever reawaken. He was about to turn and pick up the shoes he had woven the night before, when he frowned and peered under a shading hand toward the eastern horizon. If only the binoculars had been saved. He squinted, and at last he made out a line of shadows moving slowly against the brightening horizon, spindly-legged figures, and one smaller, shambling thing. A column of tiny silhouettes moved slowly northward. Tom shivered. They were headed toward the eggshell wreck. Unless he acted quickly, they would cut him off from his only chance at survival. And he could tell already that they were Tandu. Part 6 Scatter. The moot point is whether Leviathan can long endure so wide a chase and so remorseless a havoc, and the last whale, like the last man, smoke his last pipe, and then himself evaporate in the final puff. Herman Melville. Chapter 64 Crydike Sowed. Crydike stared at the hollow display and concentrated. It was easier to talk than to listen. He could call up the words one or two at a time, speak them slowly, shuttling them like pearls on a string. Neural link repaired by Jillian and McKinney. But speech still gone. Sout's image nodded. You can use tools now, though. Crydike concentrated on Sout's simple question. You can use... Each word was clear, its meaning obvious, but in a row they meant nothing. It was frustrating. Sout switched to trinary. Tools to prod, the balls, the starships. Is your jaw the player, the pilot? Crydike nodded. That was much better, though even trinary came to him like a foreign tongue, with difficulty. Spider walkers, walkers, walkers. Holocom talkers, talkers, talkers.
are my playthings, are... Krydike averted his eyes. He knew there were elements of primal in that simple phrase, in the repetition and high whistling. It was humiliating to still have an active, able mind, and know that to the outside world you sounded retarded. At the same time, he wondered if Sao noticed a trace of the language of his dreams, the voices of the old gods. Listening to the captain, Sao was relieved. Their first conversation had started off well, but toward the end, Krydike's attention had begun to wander, especially when Sao had started running him through a battery of linguistic tests. Now, after McAnee's last operation, he seemed much more attentive. He decided to test Krydike's listening ability by telling him about his discovery. He carefully and slowly explained in Trinary about the singing he had heard while linked to the robot in the drill tree funnel. Krydike looked confused for a long moment as he concentrated on Sout's slow, simplified explanation. Then he seemed to understand. In fact, from his expression, it seemed he thought it the most natural thing in the world that a planet should sing. Link. Link me. Please. I will... Listen. Listen. Sao clapped his jaw in assent, pleased. Not that Krydike, with his language centers burned, would be able to make out anything but static. It took all of Sao's subtle training and experience to trace the refrain, except for that one time when the voices from below had shouted in apparent anger. The sounds had been almost amorphous. He still shuddered, remembering that one episode of lucidity.
"Okay, Krydike," he said, as he made the connection. "Listen closely."
Krydike's eyes recessed in concentration as the static crackled and popped over the line. Chapter 65. Jillian.
Triple damn! Well, we can't wait for her to get here to start the move. It might take Hikahi 2 days to circle around in the skiff. I want to have Streaker safely inside the seahorse by then.
Suessi's simulacrum shrugged.
Well, you could leave her a note.
Jillian rubbed her eyes.
That's just what we'll do. We'll drop a monofilament relay link at Streaker's present position so we can stay in touch with the party on the island. I'll stick a message to the relay telling her where we've gone.
What about Toshio and Denny?
Jillian shrugged. I'd hope to send the skiff after them, and Sao, and maybe after Tom. But as things are, I'd better have Denny and Sao head toward your site by sled. I hate doing it. It's dangerous, and I need Toshio there watching Takata Jim until just before we take off.
She didn't mention the other reason for wanting Toshio to stay as long as possible. They both knew that Tom Orley, if he flew the glider home, would return to the island. He ought to have someone waiting for him.
Are we really going to abandon Metz and Takata Jim?
Suessi looked perplexed.
And Charlie Dart, apparently. He stowed away on the longboat, yes, it's their choice. They hope to make it home after the Galactics blow us to Kingdom Come. And for all I know, they may be right. Anyway, the final decision's Hikahi's when she finally shows up and finds out she's in command.
Jillian shook her head.
Ifni sure seems to have gone out of her way to throw us curves, hasn't she, Hannes?
The elderly engineer smiled.
Luck's always been fickle. That's why she's a lady.
But Jillian didn't have the energy to give him much of a dirty look. A light winked on the console next to the holo display.
Here it is, Hannes. The engine room is ready. I've got to go now. We're getting underway.
Good luck, Jillian.
Suessi held up an O sign, then broke the connection. Jillian flicked a switch, cutting into the comm line from Streaker to the island.
Sout, this is Jillian. Sorry to break in, but would you please tell the captain we're about to move?
It was a courtesy to let Krydike know. Streaker had been his once.
Yes, Jillian.
There was a series of high, repetitious whistles in very primal-like trinary, much of it crested over the upper range of even Jillian's gene-enhanced hearing.
The captain wants to go outside to watch,
Stout said.
He promises not to get in the way.
Jillian couldn't see any reason to refuse.
All right, but tell him to check with Wattasetti first, to use a sled and to be careful. We won't be able to spare anyone to go chasing him if he wanders off.
There was another high series of whistles that Jillian could barely follow. Krydike signaled that he understood.
Oh, by the way, Sout, Jillian added, please ask Tosho to call me as soon as the longboat arrives. Yes.
Jillian cut the connection and got up to dress. There were so many things to juggle simultaneously. I wonder if I did the right thing, letting Charlie Dart sneak away, she thought. If he or Takata Jim behave in a way I don't expect, what'll I do? A tiny light shone at the corner of her console. The NIS machine still wanted to talk to her. The light didn't flash urgent. Jillian decided to ignore it as she hurried out to supervise the move. Chapter 66 Aki. With aching muscles, Aki swam slowly out of the notch in which he had rested until dawn. He took several deep breaths and dove, scattering a school of brightly scaled fish-like creatures through shafts of morning light. Without thinking, he speared through the school and snapped up a large one, relishing its frantic struggle between his jaws. But the metal taste was bitter. He flipped the creature away, spitting. Red clouds spread a pink glow across the east as he surfaced again. Hunger growled in his compound stomachs. He wondered if the sound was loud enough to be picked up by his hunter. It's unfair. When Katha John finds me, he, at least, will have something to eat. Aki shook himself. What a bizarre thought. You're falling apart, Mitty. Katha John is no cannibal. He's a... A what? Aki remembered the final stretch yesterday at sunset, when he had somehow made it to the chain of metal mounds just meters ahead of his pursuer. The chase amidst the tiny islands had been a confusion of bubbles and surf and hunting cries. For hours after he had finally found a hiding place, he had listened to staccato bursts of sonar that proved Katha John had not gone far. Thought of the bosun sent chills down Aki's spine. What kind of creature was he? It wasn't just the irrationality of this death chase. There was something else as well, something in the way Katha John hunted. The giant sonar sweeps contained something malevolent that made Aki want to curl up in a ball. Of course, Stenos gene grafts might account for some of his size and irritability. But in Katha John there was more. Something very different must have gone into the bosun's genetic splice. Something terrifying. Something Aki, raised on Calathea, had never encountered. Aki swam close to the edge of the coral mound and stuck his jaw out beyond the northern verge. There were only the natural sounds of the Kithrip Sea. He hopped up on his tail and scanned visually. To go west or north? To Hikahi or Toshio? Better north. This chain of mounds might extend to the one where the encampment lay. It might provide cover. He dashed across the quarter-kilometer gap to the next island, then listened quietly. There was no change. Breathing a little more easily, he crossed the next channel, then the next, swimming quick bursts, then listening, then resuming his cautious passage.
Once he heard a strange, complex chatter to his right. He lay motionless until he realized that it couldn't be Githa John. He detoured slightly to take a look. It was an underwater skirmish line of balloon-like creatures with distended air bladders and lively blue faces. They carried crude implements and nets filled with thrashing prey. Except for a few holos sent back by Denny Sudman and Saud, this was Aki's first glimpse of the Kithrop natives, the Kikwi. He watched, fascinated, then swam toward them. He had thought himself still far south of Toshio, but if this group was the same... As soon as they caught sight of him, the hunters squeaked in panic. Dropping their nets, they scrambled up the vine-covered face of a nearby island. Aki realized that he must have encountered a different tribe, one which had never seen dolphins before. Still, seeing them was something. He watched the last one climb out of sight. Then he turned northward once more. But when he passed the northern shore of the next mound, a sharp beam of sound passed over him. Aki quailed. How? Had Githa John duplicated his logic about an island chain? Or had some demon instinct told him where to hunt his prey? The eerie call passed over him once more. It had mutated further during the night into a piercing, falling cry that set Aki shivering. The cry pealed again, nearer, and Aki knew he couldn't hide. That cry would seek him out in any cleft or cranny until the panic took hold. He had to make a break for it while he still had control over his mind. Chapter 67 Kipiru. The fight had begun in the pre-dawn darkness. A few hours ago, Kipiru realized that his pursuer's sled was showing no sign of failing. The engine screamed, but it would not die. Kipiru notched his own upward well beyond the red line, but it was too late. A short time later, he heard the whine of a torpedo homing in from behind. He zigged leftward and down, blowing ballast to leave a cloud of noisy bubbles in his wake. The torpedo streaked past and into the gloom beyond. An amplified squawk of disappointment and indignation echoed amongst the rills and seamounts. Kipiru was used to hearing primal obscenities from his pursuer. He had almost reached the line of metal mounds before which the two swimming dolphins had disappeared a few hours back. As he had drawn nearer, Kipiru had listened to the distant hunt cries and been chilled by a gnawing association that he couldn't bring himself yet to believe. It made him dread for Aki. Now Kipiru had his own problems. He wished Aki luck holding out until he could get rid of this idiot on his own tail. It was growing light overhead. Kipiru dove his sled behind a lumpy ridge, then throttled the engine back and waited. Moki cursed as the tiny torpedo failed to detonate. Teeth are better than things. He swung his jaw left and right. He had abandoned the sled sensors and was controlling the machine purely by habit. Where was the smart aleck? Let him come out and get it over with. Moki was tired and cranky and unutterably bored. He had never imagined that being a great bull could be so tedious. Moki wanted the hot, almost orgasmic rage back. He tried to call up the bloodlust again, but kept thinking about killing fish, not dolphins. If only he could emulate the savagery he had heard in Githa John's hunt cry. Moki no longer hated the frightening bosun. He had begun to see the giant as a spirit creature of pure and evil nature. He would kill this smart-aleck tersiops and bring its head to Githa John as proof of his worthiness as a disciple. Then he, too, would become elemental, a terror that none would ever dare thwart. Moki brought the machine about in a circle, keeping close to the seafloor to take advantage of shadows of sound. The Terseops had turned left at high speed. His turn had to be wider than Moki's, so all Moki had to do was hunt in the correct arc. Moki had been on guard duty when this chase began, so his sled had torpedoes. He was sure the smartass didn't have any. He whistled in eager anticipation of an end to the tedious chase. A sound. He turned so quickly he banged his snout against the plastic bubble dome. Moki gunned the sled forward, readying another torpedo. This one would finish his enemy off. A sheer drop opened into a broad ocean canyon. Moki took ballast and fell, hugging the wall. He throttled back and stopped. Minutes passed as the sound of muffled engines grew louder from his left. The oncoming sled was staying close to the cliff face at a greater depth. Suddenly it was below him. Moki chose not to fire right away. This was too easy. Let the smart aleck hear death suddenly fall upon him from behind, too close to evade. Let him writhe in panic before Moki's torpedo tore his body into pieces. His sled growled, then dropped in pursuit. His victim could never turn in time. Moki crowed. A herd bull is a great bull. Moki interrupted his chant. Why wasn't the smart aleck fleeing? He had been relying entirely upon sound. Only now did he turn his eye on his intended victim. The other sled was empty. It drove along slowly, unpiloted. But then where? Hunting ears can make a bull, but eyes and brains make spacemen. The voice was above him. Moki cried out, trying to turn the sled and fire a torpedo at the same time. With a despairing wail, the engine screamed and then died. His neural link went dead just as he came about into sight of a sleek, gray Terseops dolphin, 2 meters above him, white teeth shining in the light from the surface. And fools make only corpses. Moki screamed as the cutting torch on the pilot's harness exploded into laser blue brilliance. Chapter 68 Tom Orley. Where did they all come from? Tom Orley hid behind a low weed mound and looked about at the various alien parties on the horizon. He counted at least 3 groups, all converging from different directions on the floating eggshell-shaped wreck. About a mile behind him, the volcano still rumbled. He had left the crashed Thenanin scout ship at dawn, leaving a pan of precious fresh water under the dying pilot's mouth, within reach if he should ever awaken. He had set out soon after sighting the party of Tandu, testing his newly woven weed shoes on the uneven, slimy surface. The splayed snowshoe-like devices helped him walk cautiously across the slick carpet of vines. At first, he moved much faster than the others, but soon the Tandu developed a new technique. They stopped floundering in the mire and came on at a brisk walk. Tom kept low and worried about what would happen if they caught sight of him. And now, there were other parties as well, one approaching from the southwest and one from the west. He couldn't make them out clearly yet, just dots bobbing slowly and with difficulty on a long, serrated horizon. But where the hell had they all come from? The Tandu were closest. There were at least 8 or 9 of them approaching in a column. Each creature splayed its 6 spindly legs wide apart to spread its weight. In their arms, they cradled long, glistening instruments that could only be weapons. They marched forward rapidly. Tom wondered what their new tactic was. Then he noticed that the lead Tandu did not carry a weapon. Instead, it held the leash of a shaggy, shambling creature. The keeper leaned forward over its charge as if coaxing it to keep at a given task. Tom risked raising his head a couple of feet above the mound.
Well, I'll be damned.
The hairy creature was creating land, or at least solidity, in a narrow causeway in front of the party. Just before and on both sides of the trail, there was a faint shimmering where reality seemed to struggle against a noxious intrusion. An apesiarch! Momentarily, Tom forgot his predicament, grateful for this rare sight. As he watched, the causeway failed in one spot. The luminous band around the edges of the trail snapped together with a loud bang. The Tandu warrior standing there flailed and thrashed as it fell into the weeds. By fighting, it merely tore the carpet and opened the hole wider, until finally it sank like a stone into the sea. None of the other Tandu seemed to take notice. The two behind the gap leaped across to the temporarily solid ground beyond. The party, diminished by one, continued to advance. Tom shook his head. He had to reach the wreck first. He couldn't afford to let the Tandu pass him. Yet if he did anything, even resumed his own march, they'd certainly spot him. He didn't doubt their efficiency with those weapons they carried. No human warrior ever underestimated the Tandu for long. Reluctantly, he knelt and untied the fastenings on his weed shoes. Discarding them, he crawled carefully to the edge of an open pool. He counted slowly, waiting until he could hear the column of galactics approaching, rehearsing his moves in his mind. Taking several deep breaths, he pulled his diving mask over his face, making certain it was snug and the collecting fins were clear. Then he pulled his needler from its holster, holding it in two hands. Tom set his feet on two firm roots and checked his balance. The pool was just in front of him. He closed his eyes. Listen for the swishing tail of the tiger shark. His empathy sense pinpointed the powerful psi emissions of the mad ET adept, now only some 80 meters away.
Jillian, he sighed.
Then, in one sudden fluid motion, he stood up and extended his weapon. His eyes opened, and he fired. Chapter 69 Toshio. Against Toshio's objections, they had used the last of the longboat's energy to lift it to a landing site on top of the island. He had offered to blast a wider opening into the chamber below the metal mound, but Takata Jim had turned his suggestion down cold. That meant 2 hours of back-breaking work, keeping chopped foliage over the small ship to camouflage it. Toshio wasn't sure even that would do any good if the Galactics finished their battle and turned their full attention to the planet's surface. Metz and Dart were supposed to help him. Toshio had set them to work cutting brush, but found that he had to tell them to do each and every thing. Dart was sullen and angry at being commanded by a middy he had ordered around only days before. He obviously wanted to get to the supplies he had excitedly dropped by the drill tree pool before being drafted into the work crew. Metz had been willing enough, but was so anxious to be off talking to Denny that he was distracted and worse than useless. Toshio finally sent them both away and finished the job by himself. At last, the boat was covered. He slumped to the ground and rested against the bole of an olinut tree. Damn Takata Jim. Toshio and Denny were supposed to see the encampment secure, report their findings on the Kikui to Metz, and then climb on their sleds and get out of here. Jillian expected them to set out in a few hours, and yet almost nothing was accomplished. To top it all off, Streaker had only warned him an hour or so in advance that he could probably expect a stowaway. Jillian decided not to have Charlie arrested for violation of orders, even though it appeared he had stolen equipment from at least a dozen labs aboard the ship. Toshio was glad to be spared the added chore. There wasn't much of anything hereabouts to use as a jail, anyway. Foliage rustled to Toshio's left. A series of mechanical whirrings accompanied the sound of crushing vegetation. Then four spiders pushed through the brush to enter his tiny clearing. A Stenos dolphin lay on the flotation pad of each armored mechanical, controlling the four high-jointed legs with neural-link commands. Toshio stood up as they approached. Dakota Jim passed by, eyeing him coolly, silently. The other three spiders followed him across the clearing and back into the forest. The Stenos piped to each other in gutter trinary. Toshio stared after them. He discovered that he had been holding his breath. I don't know about Dakota Jim, but those Fen with him are crazier than at last peer nesters, he said to himself, shaking his head. He had met few so-called Stenos on Calathea. Some had displayed quirks, positive and negative, like Saud, but none had ever had the look that the former vice-captain's followers had in their eyes. The sound of the procession faded away. Toshio got up to his feet. He wondered why Jillian had let Takata Jim go at all. Why not just throw him and his cohorts in the brig and have done with it? Granted, it was a good idea to leave a party with the longboat to try to sneak back to Earth if Streaker was lost trying to escape. Jillian probably couldn't spare any of the reliable members of the crew, but he turned toward the village of the Kikwi, thinking as he walked. Of course the longboat was stripped. Theoretically, Dakota Jim couldn't contact the Galactics, even if he wanted to. And Toshio couldn't imagine a reason he'd want to. But what if he had a reason? And what if he found a way? Toshio almost bumped into a tree in his worried concentration. He looked up and corrected his path. I'll just have to make sure, he decided. Tonight, I'll have to find out if he can cause trouble. Tonight. The tribe's adults squatted around a circle in a clearing in the center of the village. Ignacio Metz and Denny Sudman sat to one side. The nest mother squatted across from them, her bright green and red striped puffer sacks fully inflated. The elders on either side of her billowed and chuffed like a chain of gaily painted balloons in the forest-filtered sunshine. Toshio stopped at the edge of the village clearing. Sunshine filtered through the trees, revealing a conclave of races. The Kikwi nest mother chattered, waving her paws in a queer up-and-down pattern that Denny had said connoted happy emphasis. If the oldest female had been angry, her gestures would have been crosswise. It was a blissfully simple expression pattern. The rest of the tribe repeated her sounds, sometimes anticipating her in a rising and falling chant of consensus. Ignacio Metz nodded excitedly, cupping one hand over an earphone as he listened to the translation computer. When the chant died down, he spoke a few words into a microphone. A long series of high-pitched, repetitive squeaks came out of the machine speaker. Denny's expression was one of relief. She had dreaded the uplift specialist's first meeting with the Kikwi. But Metz had not, apparently, muffed her long and careful negotiations with the pre-sentients. The meeting seemed to be coming to a satisfactory conclusion. Denny caught sight of Toshio and smiled brilliantly. Without ceremony, she stood up and left the circle. She hurried over to where he waited at the edge of the village clearing. "How's it going?" he asked.
"Wonderfully. It turns out he's read every word I sent back. He understands their pack protocol, their physical manifestations of sex and age, and he thought my behavioral analysis was exemplary. Exemplary!"
Toshio smiled, sharing her pleasure.
He's talking about getting me an appointment as a fellow at the Uplift Center. Can you imagine that?
Denny couldn't help bouncing up and down excitedly.
What about the treaty? Oh, they're ready any time. If Hikahi makes it here in the skiff, we'll take a dozen Kikui back to Streaker with us. Otherwise, a few will go back to Earth with Metz in the longboat. It's all settled.
Toshio looked back at the happy villagers and tried not to show his misgivings. Of course, it was for the good of the Kikui as a species. They would fare far better under the patronage of mankind than under almost any other starfaring race. And Earth geneticists had to have living beings to examine before any sort of adoption claim could be made. Every attempt would be made to keep the first group of aboriginals healthy. Half of Denny's job had been to analyze their bodily requirements, including needed trace elements. But it was still unlikely any of the first group would survive. Even if they did, Toshio doubted the Kikui had a notion of the strangeness they were about to embark upon. They're not sentients yet, he reminded himself. By galactic law, they're still animals, and unlike anyone else in the five galaxies, we'll at least try to explain to their limited understanding and ask permission. But he remembered a stormy night with driving rain and flashing lightning, when the little amphibians had huddled around him and an injured dolphin who was his friend, keeping them warm and warding off despair with their company. He turned away from the sun-washed clearing.
"Then there's nothing keeping you here any longer?" he asked Denny.
She shook her head.
"I'd rather stay a while longer, of course. Now that I'm finished with the Kikui, I can really work on the problem of the metal mound. That's why I was so grouchy a couple of days ago. Besides being so tired trying to do two major jobs, I was also frustrated. But now we're a step closer to solving that problem. And did you know the core of the metal mound is still alive? It's..."
Toshio had to interrupt to stop the flow of words.
"Denny, stop it for a minute, please. Answer my question. Are you ready to leave now?"
Denny blinked. She changed tracks, frowning.
"Is it Streaker? Has something gone wrong?" "They began to move a few hours ago. I want you to gather all of your notes and samples and secure them to your sled. You and Saud are leaving in the morning."
She looked at him, his words slowly sinking in.
"You mean you, me, and Saud, don't you?"
"No, I'm staying for another day. I have to."
"But why?"
"Look, Denny, I can't talk about it now. Just do as I ask, please."
As he turned to walk back toward the drill tree pool, she grabbed his arm. Holding on, she was forced to follow.
"But we were going to go together. If you have things to do here, I'll wait for you."
He walked along without answering. He couldn't think of anything to say. It was bitter to win her respect and affection at last, only to lose her within hours. "But this is what being grown up means. They can have it," he thought. "It sucks." As they approached the pool, sounds of loud argument came from that direction. Toshio hurried. Denny trotted alongside until they burst into the clearing. Charles Dart screamed and clutched at a slender cylinder that was gripped at the other end by the manipulator arm of Takata Jim's spider. Charlie strained against the pull of the Waldo machine. Takata Jim grinned open-mouthed. The tug-of-war lasted for a few seconds as the Neo-Chimp's powerful muscles strained. Then the cylinder popped out of his hands. He fell back to the dust and barely stopped before rolling into the pool. He hopped up and shrieked his anger. Toshio saw three other Stenos-controlled spiders trooping off toward the longboat. Each carried another of the thin cylinders. Toshio stopped in his tracks when he got a good look at the one Takata Jim had taken. His eyes went wide.
"There is no longer any danger," Takata Jim told him.
His voice carried insouciance.
"I have confiscated these. They'll be kept safe aboard my boat, and there will be no harm.
They're mine, you thief!
Charles Dart hopped angrily, and his hands fluttered.
You criminal!
He growled.
You think I don't know you tried to murder Crydanky? We all know you did. You wrecked the buoys to destroy the evidence, and now you steal the tools of my trade.
Which you stole from Streaker's armory, no doubt, or do you wish to call Dr. Baskin for confirmation that they truly are yours? Dart growled and showed an impressive display of teeth. He whirled away from the Neo-Dolphin and sat down in the dust in front of a complex diving robot, freshly unpacked on the verge of the pool. Takata Jim's spider started to turn, but the Finn noticed Toshio looking at him. For just a moment, Takata Jim's cool reserve broke under the youth's fierce gaze. He looked away, and then back at Toshio. Don't believe everything you hear, boy human, he said. Much I have done and will do, and I'm convinced I am right. But it was not I who hurt Crydanky.
Did you destroy the buoys?
Toshio could sense Denny standing close behind him, watching the large dolphin silently over his shoulder. Yes, but it was not I who set the trap. Like King Henry with Becket, I only found out about it after. Tell this on Earth, if by some strange chance you should escape, and I don't. Another took the initiative.
Who did it, then?
Toshio's fists were tight balls. A long sigh escaped Takata Jim's blowmouth. Our Dr. Metz wrung from the survey board berths for some who shouldn't have been on this voyage. He was impatient. A few of his Stenos had unusual family trees.
The Stenos?
A few Stenos. I am not one of Metz's experiments. I am a starship officer. I earn my place. The dolphin's voice was defiant. When the pressure built to the breaking point, some of them turned to me. I thought I could control them, but there was one who turned out to be more than even I could manage. Tell them if you go home, Toshio Iwashika. Tell them on Earth that it's possible to turn a dolphin into a monster. And they should be warned. Takata Jim gave him one long, intent look. Then his spider turned away and followed his crew back to the longboat.
He's a liar, Denny whispered after he had gone. He sounds so reasonable and logical, but I shiver when I listen to him.
Toshio watched the spider disappear down the trail. No, he said. He is ambitious and maybe crazy, too. He's probably a traitor as well, but for some reason, I think everything he said was explicitly true. Maybe a surface honesty is what he clings to now, for pride's sake. He turned, shaking his head. Not that that makes him any less dangerous. He approached Charles Dart, who looked up with a friendly smile. Toshio squatted near the chimp planetologist.
Dr. Dart, how big were they?
Were what, Toshio? Say, have you seen this new robot? I made it up special. It can dive to the base of the shaft, then dig laterally to those big magma tunnels we detected.
How big were they, Charlie?
Toshio demanded. He was tense and ready to throttle the chimpanzee.
Tell me!
Dart glanced briefly, guiltily, at Toshio, then looked down at the pool wistfully.
Only about a kiloton each, he sighed. Hardly big enough to set off decent crust waves, really.
He looked up with large, innocent brown eyes.
They were really only teeny little A-bombs. Honest.
This ends side one of cassette 9.